Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The investigation into yesterday's terrorist attacks is well underway in London. The bombings have left at least 50 people dead and over 700 injured. Sir Ian Blair, Commissioner of the London Metro Police, has urged the public to be patient, saying the investigation will depend on forensic evidence from very challenging scenes. Well, joining us now from the offices of Sky News Radio in London is Andrew Ivey. And Andrew, if you could first address two reports that we're hearing. The first is that U.S. intelligence officials are reporting that the bombings, or saying that the bombings may be linked to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Your thoughts on that report?
Yes, it's, it's difficult to see at this stage whether there is any direct link. As you know, in these situations, very often you get a report on a remote website somewhere. It's a group that no one's ever heard of before, and it's virtually impossible to verify any claims that we've had so far. There was one group which was linked to al-Qaeda which claimed it last night, but again, no one's been able to confirm that. As for those reports you mentioned, nothing coming out of London at the moment. There are obviously reports from unnamed officials, but in a situation like that, there could be information worldwide that's being collated. Mm. And the police, I think, are being very careful with the information, certainly here, that they release.
The second report, and I know you probably can't comment on it, but the Wall Street Journal is reporting that a Moroccan man, a suspect in last year's Madrid attack, may also have been involved in yesterday's bombing. But again, it's probably impossible to know.
Again, yes, there's nothing like that is really being mentioned here. I think the focus here today has been on getting the city back and moving and people going back to work, as well as, of course, the recovery operation. As your listeners will know, there were four explosions, three on the subway and one on a bus, and we've been getting more information through the day. And within the last hour or so, we've been told that on that bus there were 13 people who died. Mm. When you think one of these buses probably holds maybe 50 people maximum, that's an awful lot of people on one bus. And the other main focus of the rescue operation is on one of the underground trains, the subway trains, which is in a deep tunnel. And it's been very difficult for the services to recover bodies from there.
We know that the police are saying that the explosives weighed less than 10 pounds each. Do they know how they were detonated?
No, they don't think that they were detonated by mobile phone, which was one theory, because, again, there's no mobile phone signal in a deep tunnel like that. There's some suggestion there may have been timers, and they think that they were possibly left on the floor. There's no indication yet whether suicide bombers were involved. If they were, then that would be the first time that suicide bombers had struck here in London.
Mm. Andrew Ivey again at Sky News. I wonder if you can give us a sense of how Londoners are feeling as they head home. This is the end of the work week for them. These bombings followed Live 8, the G8 gathering in Scotland, and the jubilant Olympics announcement celebration, and then the bombings. What is the mood at the end of this unbelievable week?
Well, as you say, the Wednesday to Thursday, the contrast could not have been greater. Wednesday in Trafalgar Square, which I'm sure your listeners know, if they've been there themselves maybe, or seen it on television, a famous London landmark, filled with people jumping up and down for joy at the news that London was to host the 2012 Olympics, and less than 24 hours later, awful scenes here in London. But I think
we hear the Queen is out and about, though, and the royal family.
She has. Yeah, she's been to visit some of the injured people in hospital in the East End. Actually, rather reminiscent of the Queen Mother, her mother, mm. who during the Blitz in World War II, when London was being bombed by the Germans, or rather the Nazis, she went to visit people in the East End and was hailed as a sort of a national figure who kept morale together. And I think the Queen perhaps sees her role some way. Mm. Similar.
Andrew Ivey, editor for Sky News Radio in London. Andrew, thanks for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Meanwhile, Muslims in Britain are very concerned about a backlash following yesterday's bombings in London, even though police in Britain have not confirmed that Islamic extremists were involved in that attack. The Muslim Council of Britain has issued a statement roundly condemning the attacks. And joining us on the line is a spokesperson, Inayat Bunglawala. Inayat, welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We mentioned that your organization released a statement roundly condemning the attacks. What else have you done in the wake of the bombings?
Well, we've been keeping close tabs on the situation in the UK, and following the 9/11 attacks, you know, which occurred across the Atlantic, we saw a spate of attacks upon British Muslims, And overnight, we've heard that a mosque in Leeds was firebombed. And New Scotland Yard this morning reported there have been at least two assaults upon British Muslims since yesterday. So we're watching the situation carefully, but at the same time, urging British Muslims not to give in to the politics of fear, which is exactly what the terrorists would have wanted. And it's right to be cautious, but we don't want to be fearful, or overly fearful anyway.
Well, one of the bombings was in a primarily Muslim neighborhood, the Edgware Road station, and it's a very colorful neighborhood with Lebanese restaurants, with belly dancers and women in long robes and veils. And we understand that there are reports of white Britons suddenly coming up from the tube in that neighborhood, and one man saying on his cell phone, "Everyone here looks like a Muslim terrorist to me." Sort of a sudden confrontation between two populations. Is that the kind of thing that you're worried about?
I do not believe they're representative at all, and I mean, London has such a mix of communities and cultures. Not just Edgware Road, Robin, but Aldgate East as well, which suffered an explosion, is an area which has the highest Muslim concentration in the entire country. So, yes, many of the victims, many of the casualties from yesterday's atrocities will have been Muslims. And 10% of London's population, of course, is Muslim.
And Ayad, I wonder if you could explain for us. We understand that the Muslim community in Britain is one of the most integrated in all of Europe, and that up to 2001, Britain took a very different tact towards extremists, and the Muslim community works very closely with police and other officials. But it feels as if, from reports we've read, the relationship has changed somewhat in the last couple of years. Is that true?
It's true that the government has enacted a whole series of anti-terror measures since the 9/11 attacks. And these measures, by their very nature, have impacted disproportionately upon British Muslims, many of whom have been arrested and questioned by police, only to be later released without charge. And it is that nature, the nature of that engagement, whereby many Muslims are picked up off the streets, taken in for questioning by the police, and then released after a few days, which has created some resentment that they're being targeted for targeted in a way no other community is, and there is a measure of resentment about that.
We understand that in the past, Britain's tact was to monitor radical extremists rather than arrest them, so as not to drive them underground. Now, as you said, there's been more roundups, but I'm also curious because we understand that many of the Muslims who are in Britain are taking sanctuary there, and their concerns for years were with their home country governments, Lebanon, for instance. And now Muslims living in Britain are more concerned with Britain's foreign policy.
Well, it's true that the recent participation of our government in the war against Afghanistan, in the war against Iraq, has led to a lot of disenchantment amongst Muslims, especially Muslim youth. And they've been increasingly vocal. They've participated in many anti-war demonstrations in this country. However, there is, a huge gulf between participating in anti-war demonstrations and involving yourself in terrorist activities. Mm-hmm. So it remains to be seen who carried out yesterday's atrocities. But whoever they were, whether they were Muslim or not, one thing is certain, they certainly were not Islamic. And this point cannot be emphasized enough, that the Muslim community has repeatedly condemned all manifestations of terrorism. And just as the Prime Minister pointed out yesterday, whoever these people finally turn out to be, it is entirely wrong to blame British Muslims. And in our city of London has suffered terrorist attacks in the past. In the 70s and 80s, we suffered regular terrorist attacks at the hands of the IRA. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there was unfortunately a lot of prejudice against Irish people displayed, throughout the country. And we hope we will have learnt to distinguish now between those who perpetrate acts like yesterday's atrocity and the mainstream Muslim community who are just as repulsed, just as disgusted by the targeting of innocents, as we saw yesterday.
Inayat Bunglawala, a spokesperson for the Muslim Council of Britain. One last two-part question. Richard Reid, the notorious shoe bomber, was recruited in a mosque outside London, north of London. The leader of that mosque went on trial July 5th, just this week, for inciting violence against non-Muslims. First question, do you think that that trial might have had anything to do with yesterday's attack? And secondly, how does your group counter that kind of radicalism in the mosques?
Okay, first of all, it's too early to say whether yesterday's attacks were, in any way related to the trial of Abu Hamza until we know for sure who these people were that perpetrated the attack. It's not really profitable to indulge in speculation. But regarding the second part of your question, which was that what the Muslim Council of Britain is doing to counteract the influence of radical figures, remember that Abu Hamza was in charge of one mosque in Finsbury Park, and he'd since been removed from that. He was removed by the police, and that mosque is now back under community control. It is one of over 800 mosques throughout the country. There's never been any suggestion whatsoever that any other mosque has been involved in inciting hatred of non-Muslims in this country or indulging in any of these kinds of acts, preparatory to terrorism, if you like. The Muslim Council of Britain has had a very long and hard struggle to try and portray British Muslims as being utterly dissociated from the kinds of activities that Richard Reid and others are involved in. But it's a difficult one because, of course, the tabloids like that kind of sensationalism. They gave Abu Hamza more coverage than, his mosque got more coverage than all the others put together, and it therefore created a very skewed impression about what British Muslims stand for. It's like if we were to come to the United States and all we were to focus upon is the Ku Klux Klan. It would give a very skewed impression about what, the ordinary American stands for. We know that the Ku Klux Klan exists, but, they are by no means representative of ordinary American opinion. And the same thing was the case with Abu Hamza and his mosque. And that mosque is now under community control. And the Muslim Council of Britain is doing its best to try and overturn the very, very negative impression left by years of very sensationalist tabloid coverage.
We asked if you feared backlash from the white British community.
Yeah.
Do you fear it from the Muslim community?
No, we certainly do not fear any backlash from the Muslim community. Our Muslim community at this moment is quite fearful. It feels unsettled and almost under siege. And the comments made by the Prime Minister yesterday, in which he sought to reassure British Muslims, were enormously welcome. And I think they will be reciprocated by British Muslims. I don't think we'll see any backlash from British Muslims themselves.
Inayat Bunglawala is a spokesperson for the Muslim Council of Britain, an umbrella movement of hundreds of smaller organizations. And Inayat, we really appreciate talking to you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And just ahead, we'll speak with an American security expert about holes in the security net here in the U.S. And later in the program, are seatbelts just as safe as car seats for children over two? Yes, according to the authors of the best-selling book Freakonomics. We'll hear about it. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Moscow's subway system was attacked in 2004. Commuter trains in Madrid suffered the same fate in 2004. Yesterday, London. And U.S. officials say intelligence shows al-Qaeda operatives cased out New York's subway systems before and after 9/11. Are U.S. cities prepared for an attack? And do officials here really understand who the attackers are? Joining us on the line is Roger Cressy. He worked with Richard Clark in the Clinton and Bush administration's counterterrorism offices, and he's now president of Good Harbor, a security consulting firm he founded with Richard Clark. Welcome, Roger.
Thanks, Robin.
And we hear that there's a raging debate in the intelligence community now as to what exactly is al-Qaeda. Has it morphed into local cells with no real affiliation with Osama bin Laden? Or are these still attacks that are directed, as someone has said, from a cave on the border of Afghanistan? First of all, what is your thought as to what the U.S. And Britain and other countries are confronting? What is al-Qaeda?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think since 9/11, we've seen al-Qaeda as an organization, a hierarchical group that we knew prior to 9/11 in steep decline through a number of efforts on our part and just an overall focus on them. At the same time, though, there has been this growth and a rise in a global Sunni extremist movement, which includes al-Qaeda affiliates, which includes groups and individuals with no previous al-Qaeda link, but now support the al-Qaeda cause. So, Robin, the good news is we're doing really well against the al-Qaeda 1.0. The bad news is this new global movement is a far more deadly and difficult foe to deal with.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. What is the difference? What does it matter whether these attacks are al-Qaeda-directed attacks or al-Qaeda-inspired?
With an al-Qaeda organization that was hierarchical, you could identify the senior leadership, you could pick them off, you could eliminate their sanctuary and tear apart their network limb by limb. Now with this global movement, it's comprised of people that we don't know, people who don't appear in anyone's no-fly list or terrorism database, number one. Number two, it's organizations that previously were looking to conduct attacks against their local governments for very narrow reasons, but now are conducting inspired attacks on behalf of al-Qaeda because they support bin Laden's philosophy, and they've been energized by a number of things, including, of course, the war in Iraq.
And so this is more a Madrid model than a 9/11 model.
That's absolutely right, and it's a much more difficult model to deal with because in Madrid you had a gathering of individuals, drug traffickers, who could care less about the jihadist philosophy, but were key in developing the process to get the explosives for the attack. You had former adherents to al-Qaeda who went through the training camps. You had local extremists as well as Moroccan extremists all came together in a relatively short period of time to conduct the Madrid attack. What I fear is we have a similar situation in London now.
All right. Well, let's turn to domestic security. If that is the thinking, what are the concerns about keeping American cities safe?
The one advantage we have over Europe is we have a Muslim population that is integrated into our society for all intents and purposes. In Europe, the Islamic population is disenfranchised. It was never integrated, and it's a breeding ground for extremism. In the United States, it's a much better story. Now, that doesn't mean there are no extremists in our Islamic community. There are certainly some, but it's much more, we have an advantage over the Europeans in that respect.
What about here in the U.S.? Are cities prepared for these kinds of attacks?
You know, our challenge, Robin, is we are a reactive society. We see attacks and then we immediately respond to improve security based on the last attack. So we've done a lot of work with airport security. We've not done as much work with rail security.
Yeah. And, well, in fact, let's go to just one detail to make that point. In 2001, the New York Police Department and the Fire Department couldn't communicate to each other effectively because they had incompatible radio communications. We all remember that horror at 9/11. Well, here we are 4 years later. Apparently, the police department and the fire department still don't have interoperable communications. And you make a point that, in fact, it goes much wider than that.
Well, what you see is the federal government has thrown money at the state and local authorities and said, it's your problem, you understand it better than we do, here, go off and spend. The problem with that approach is there's no rhyme nor reason to the spending, and therefore there's no metric to determine are you getting anything for the money you've spent. You can buy a lot of radios. You can buy new fire equipment. Does that increase interoperability? Does that increase the capability? The lack of metrics, Robin, is a real problem in how we've been spending our homeland security dollars.
What else do you see as glaring weaknesses in the U.S.?
Well, there are several Achilles heels, one of which is cybersecurity. Our nation's economy and our nation's security is very reliant upon cyberspace right now. And frankly, the administration has really fallen on its face in trying to do more on cybersecurity. They just don't believe it's as important an issue as the other ones they're dealing with.
Well, give me an example of why you think there's a problem. I mean, elaborate.
Well, for example, there are digital control systems that are used by utilities, by oil and gas, by power companies, all of which ride on top of the Internet. They are inherently insecure.
And Roger Cressy, we want to let you get your plane, but I want to ask one last question, the human element. Yesterday, we've all talked to many friends in London who said it was astonishing. Londoners were told, once the attacks happened, to stay in their homes. And most of them did. They stayed right in their homes. They didn't get in their cars. We had a reporter who said, no, I can't go out on the street. I'm not allowed to go out on the street. I mean, people, for the most part, did what they were told. Your sense of how the U.S. might respond, your sense of how Londoners did.
Well, I think they did a spectacular job. And you look at how we as a nation responded to 9/11. There was a certain level of stoicism, a resolute response. And I'm confident that, God forbid, we have another attack, we'll have a similar type of reaction by the American people. But it requires awareness, it requires education, and just a preparation to accept the world has changed and we're dealing with these unknowns now. Just be prepared to go with it no matter what happens. I think that's the key.
Roger Cressy has worked in both the Clinton and Bush administration's counterterrorism offices. He's now president of Good Harbor, a security consulting firm. He's speaking to us from the airport in Washington as he awaits his flight, and we appreciate it, Roger. Thank you.
Robin, thanks so much.
And next week on Here and Now, one man's gripping story of survival as thousands were slaughtered around him in Srebrenica 10 years ago. Also, a conversation with Amy Mann, still making music on her own terms. That's next week. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In their best-selling nonfiction book, Freakonomics, writer Stephen Dubner and economist Stephen Levitt revealed the economics of everyday life, everything from abortion to McDonald's, with surprising, or as the book's title suggests, freaky results. Well, in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, the pair write about the economics of car seats for young children. And they pose a controversial question, and Stephen Dubner joins us on the line to tell us about it. Stephen, the question is...
The question is, how much good do child car seats do, especially compared to the seat belts that already exist in cars? That's the question.
And in fact, you ask, is it possible that seat belts might afford them the same protection as car seats?
Yeah, as it turns out, we measured most intensely children ages 2 and up, because when you have really little ones, you know, an infant and even a toddler, it's, you know, not really practical for them to sit up in a seat without a car seat anyway. But if you really look at the data, which we did, and take all the fatal crashes in the U.S. since 1975, there's a nice government database that lets you do that, and you kind of measure every which way you can, controlling for all different kinds of crashes and makes of cars and so on, it turns out that children who ride in a seat belt, whether it's a lap and shoulder belt or just a lap belt, do just as well as kids in car seats. If you think about it, the whole idea of a car seat is kind of, I don't want to say ridiculous, because obviously a lot of people mean really well, but you've got a car that's built to be safe by having these very rigid seats that are built strong, and then the idea of introducing this, you know, add-on item, this plastic seat with complicated straps that most parents have a hard time hooking up.
Right, which isn't even usually installed correctly.
Yeah, that's a big, big problem. And you know, in the column, we write about how we commissioned our own crash test. So we went to a crash test lab and had this engineer strap in two different car seats and then test them against crash test dummies who were just in the lap and shoulder belts. And even with the engineer-installed ones, the dummies in the lap and shoulder belts did just as well.
Well, Stephen Dubner, this is blasphemy. You know that, don't you? And, you know, in many states, it's illegal to drive with a child over two without a car seat or a booster seat.
In all states. And it's actually getting much more regulated. NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, I believe, they are continuing to push regulations state by state, so that older and older children are required to ride in booster seats. And the idea is a nice one. The idea is to boost the kids up to make the seat belts fit better. But what we argue is that for all this money and regulation and anxiety that goes into a very, very imperfect solution, that is car seats and booster seats, wouldn't it be nice if a more optimal solution, which was reached, which probably would be to build good integrated safety belts in the cars that are adjustable for kids, because that would plainly be a much safer way to go.
You say even harnesses for instance, for kids?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the seatbelts that exist are really good. They're too big for children. Can they be adjusted? Yes. Could they also be modified to fit children better? Yes, they could.
Yeah.
And some manufacturers do that. Volvo does it already. Chrysler and minivans have it. But, you know, what Freakonomics is really about is incentives and trying to figure out where incentives lie and then use data to kind of find the real story. Well, the federal government has a big incentive to recommend car seats because who's going to argue against child safety? The car manufacturers have a big incentive to let people use car seats because then they're not responsible for anything because it's a third party. The third parties who are manufacturing these car seats, well, they have a nice incentive. They sell 4 or 5 million car seats a year. It's the consumers, not atypically, unfortunately, who kind of, you know, are left most in the dark. And what we're trying to do is just use data to show, you know, the actual, you know, the realities behind real life.
Well, why is it, though, that, I mean, there's a perception, certainly. You just feel like you're doing something for your child when you wrestle that darn thing, you know, into the seat. So it feels like you're doing something to protect them, putting on a lifesaver, you know.
All the hallmarks of, you know, a really great safety device, right? It's big and bulky, it's expensive, and it's hard to install. So we assume it has to be really good for you.
Isn't it also true that fatalities have gone down and people draw a direct correlation between that and car seats?
They've gone down a lot. And here's the important thing to remember. What holds a car seat in place in the car? It's the seatbelt, right? So we know that seatbelts work very, very well for just about any passenger in any situation. Since the federal government has been regulating car seats and since states have been demanding their use, child fatalities have gone down and continue to go down. But what we were trying to do in the data is see, is that because children are in car seats per se, or is it because children are riding restrained, whereas in the old days they used to ride unrestrained? Mm. And the answer plainly is restraint. So we're not telling people to throw away their car seats at all. In fact, it would be illegal in every state to do so. What we're saying is that if you want to be realistic about child safety and use the actual data of real car crashes instead of crash test data that's supplied either by the government or by the manufacturers, you'll see that car seats seem to be providing practically no benefit for an awful lot of money, and we just think there's probably a much better solution.
Right. It's being restrained that's saving lives.
Yeah. In other words, if you have a 2-year-old kid and you don't have a car seat, some people might be tempted to put them on the lap in the front seat, or you think you don't have your booster seat and the strap is riding a little bit high on the child's chest, and it's not riding where it should, so you'll just let him ride unrestrained. That's the bad thing to do, because it's riding restrained that is the great gain. But as we write in the Times column and then on our website, which is just freakonomics.com, we'll have some extra information up there that kind of walks anybody who wants to through the government data, where you can actually see exactly how the different methods of restraint add up in terms of fatalities and injuries, and that seatbelts, even though they don't fit children well, do just as good a job. So it seems to us that the obvious solution is, since we have these things that already exist, that are already in cars, that already do a very good job, wouldn't it be better, instead of introducing this other piece of machinery, this contraption, to try to make them work better?
Stephen Dubner, co-author of Freakonomics, the bestseller about the economics of just about everything in life. He and co-author Stephen Levitt have written an article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine raising the blasphemous question, could possibly seatbelts be as protective of children over 2 years old as car seats? Stephen, I know you're going to start a lot of conversation.
Let's hope.
Stephen Dubner, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And if you've wrestled a car seat into a car, or if you feel that your child was safe by one, you probably have some thoughts. As always, we welcome them on car seats or anything that you've heard on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. If you call or if you write, please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, who doesn't like baseball? Well, the International Olympic Committee, that's who. We'll find out why baseball's booted out of the Olympics. You're listening to Here and Now. Iraq is asking that Egypt explain what a top Egyptian envoy was doing in reaching out to Iraqi insurgents. Egypt has confirmed that career diplomat Ihab al-Sharif, the first formally designated Arab government representative to Iraq, was killed after being kidnapped this past weekend. Egyptian officials offer no proof, and a video of al-Sharif made by his captors does not show his death. This is a potentially explosive story in the region. Egypt is largely Sunni, and the Iraq insurgency is now also largely Sunni. The remaining staff of the Egyptian embassy in Iraq is quietly pulling out of Baghdad today. Borzu Daragahi is the Los Angeles Times correspondent in Baghdad. We spoke with him yesterday. Now, it was originally thought that al-Sharif, the Egyptian diplomat, was kidnapped while picking up a paper. We asked Borzu, what's the new thinking?
It seems that it's quite possible that he, in fact, was not going out to buy a newspaper, but that he may have been lured out. The Interior Ministry has been making sort of these cryptic remarks that he had some communications with the insurgents. Perhaps he was trying to negotiate something with the insurgents, and he may have been lured out of his house and attempting to meet with some people when he was kidnapped. They warned diplomats not to make contact with any insurgent groups without checking with the Ministry of Interior first.
Well, we know that this group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has posted a video of the blindfolded diplomat identifying himself. Do we learn any more from the video?
No, they don't show anything. They don't, as some listeners know, some of these tapes, they contain very grisly images of the person being butchered to death. And this particular tape had none of that. It just showed him, and then they made a claim of responsibility for having killed him.
As we said earlier this week, Egypt is the first Arab government to say that it will send an ambassador to Baghdad. But then again, this high-ranking envoy was the first to be kidnapped. Is there a sense of, you know, how chilling an effect this has been?
This has absolutely sent shudders throughout the diplomatic community here. You know, people come here. It is not exactly the most romantic diplomatic post. You think about the typical person who goes into the Foreign Service. They want to go out and have adventures. Most of the diplomats in Iraq are frightened, huddled behind barricades, and rarely going out. And this just underscores the dangers for any of the foreigners in the country.
How are the British bombings resonating in Baghdad at all?
I don't know if it's resonating any. As far as the Iraqi people are concerned, they're watching it kind of intently. And I don't think anyone is happy that this happened. The British keep a very low profile here, so it's not like, you know, the British have gotten their comeuppance or anything like that. I don't know what the sentiment in the South is. I imagine it's not like that at all. Mm-hmm. There's been some statements of condemnation from the government, but nothing extraordinary.
Borzu, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Los Angeles Times reporter Borzu Daragahi, we spoke to him yesterday in Baghdad. And these news stories that we're following, the Associated Press is reporting that Italy plans to begin withdrawing some of its troops from Iraq in September. Premier Silvio Berlusconi was a strong supporter of President Bush on Iraq. He sent 3,000 troops to the country after the ouster of Saddam Hussein to help rebuild Iraq. And he had previously indicated he hoped a pullout could begin. Well, Berlusconi confirmed today a withdrawal of 300 men in the month of September, adding that that decision would depend on security conditions on the ground, and that decision could change. And we're also following another story today. Rain from approaching Hurricane Dennis has started to fall in the Florida Keys. Dennis was blamed for at least 5 deaths in Haiti. The strong Category 4 storm is expected to weaken slightly as it passes over Cuba this afternoon, but forecasters say it will remain extremely dangerous and capable of causing extensive damage and flooding as the first waves of the storm pass into the Straits of Florida tonight. Parts of the Florida Keys were evacuated yesterday, and Florida Governor Jeb Bush said the storm could become a major disaster in a state still recovering from 4 hurricanes last year. The National Hurricane Center says the path of the storm could change, but the center of Dennis is expected to pass west of the Keys early Saturday. The storm's arms could then brush Florida's west coast before arriving ashore Sunday. We'll stay on top of that story. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At the International Olympic Committee meeting in Singapore today, the head of the British Olympic Committee vowed that yesterday's deadly bombings in London will not affect the city's resolve to stage a successful Olympics in 2012. But as the head of the Olympic Committee pointed out, events there highlight the need for security to remain the number one priority of the Olympic movement. Here to talk Olympics and much more news from the world of sports, host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And as IOC President Jacques Rogu, did I say his name correctly?
Roga,
said security has to be even more of the minds of everyone today. I mean, it must be the buzz.
Well, it's been on the minds of people producing Olympics in various cities for such a long time now. But yeah, I suppose so, especially immediately following the explosions in London. Of course, 7 years is a long time, and who knows what will happen between now and 2012.
Who knows what the landscape will be. We remember that the bombing at the Atlanta Olympics was from an anti-abortion activist, so one does not know. There was also some news out of the Olympic Committee meeting today that we are just recovering from. Say it ain't so. Are they seriously considering dropping baseball and softball?
Worse than seriously considering.
They've done it.
They've done it. And the reasons are quite simple on at least one front. They're very expensive to produce. You have to build a baseball stadium, you have to build a softball venue, and then when the Olympics goes away, there's nothing to do in those places. For many of the places where the Olympics are held, there's just no interest in baseball or softball at any other time. The other reason, of course, for eliminating softball is the U.S. team always won, and that had begun to irritate some people in the rest of the world, I guess.
Well, but, you know, too bad for especially the U.S. women. They've won all three gold since 1996 when it was added. So it's sort of, oh, they're great at it. They get a few years at it, and it gets dropped.
That's right, exactly.
Okay. And conversely, though, and I checked my thinking on this, didn't the U.S. start to lose on the baseball side?
Yeah, well, that's ironically that one of the reasons that baseball has been eliminated, besides the fact that it requires an expensive venue, which is something of a white elephant, is that the major league players don't go. And so it isn't the kind of attraction, say, that basketball is in the Olympics, where NBA stars, you know, can be counted on to go and thereby draw large and interested crowds. Mm.
Well, turning to the Tour de France, a cyclist Lance Armstrong, of course, we all know his story. He's still leading the Tour de France, avoiding that crash in the rain in the seventh stage. They look so glorious on the bikes, and in a split second, they look so awful in that pile that gets created. But is anyone in a position to beat him?
Well, according to the people that I've talked to, several folks are in a position to beat him, but something unexpected would have to happen for any of them to be able to accomplish that. I think the major story of the Tour de France, once again, is that Lance Armstrong owns the race. Mm. And it is really just absolutely unprecedented that one athlete should so dominate an event like that the way that he has.
Right. And now they head into the mountains, so we'll all be watching. On to some other news. This is a big week if you're an All-Star fan.
Yes, it is. The WNBA All-Star Game coming up this weekend. And Connecticut is superbly represented. Your Connecticut Sun, one of the top teams, if not the top team in the WNBA. Taj McWilliams-Franklin, Nikisha Sales, of course, and several UConn alums represented on the two rosters.
You know, God bless you, Bill Littlefield, because if it weren't for you, I don't think women's sports would get mentioned anywhere. I, of course, was actually thinking about baseball.
Oh.
You know, this Tuesday, the All-Star Game takes place in Detroit. The Red Sox have more starters than any team since 1976.
Well, they won the World Series, as you'll recall.
Yeah, and on the national side, last year's champion Cardinals have five players. But I understand you have a beef about at least one of those Red Sox players.
Well, a beef, maybe putting it a little too strongly.
That's what I want.
Controversy. I'm not always sure the fans, when they vote for the starters of the All-Star team, make the best decisions. I'm an Ichiro Suzuki guy. I think he's one of the finest pure baseball players for anybody to appreciate on the baseball scene today.
And remind us.
And instead, Ichiro will not be starting in the outfield. Johnny Damon will be a self-confessed idiot who has the reputation for having perhaps the worst arm in the major leagues. So that's not exactly a quality you want in your center fielder.
Wait, does he really?
Absolutely. great hitter, great leadoff hitter, very handsome.
Great leader.
Depending on whether you want your leader to call everybody an idiot and say all kinds of things that we can't say on the radio in the clubhouse and elsewhere. But, you know, great player, attractive player, apparently women's favorite Major League Baseball player these days, I'm told. But, you know, Ichiro is such a brilliant practitioner of the game. If you've ever watched him hit, the man's concentration is absolutely astonishing. Even in a game where it's 11 to nothing, he comes up, every at-bat counts. Great player.
And remind us, he's with?
Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pedro Martinez, a little baseball note, former Red Sox and now with the Mets. He's not going to pitch. He's pulling out of the game for some additional rest.
Yeah, Pedro is pulling a Pedro. It's what he usually does. He always gets invited to the All-Star game, and he generally finds some reason not to go. I'm being a little unfair. He is scheduled to pitch within 2 days of the All-Star game, so he wouldn't exactly be ready.
We want to skip and get some other sports in here because we want to talk about 15-year-old golfing phenom Michelle Wee. Mm-hmm. She's playing in her third PGA tournament against the men. Mm-hmm. If you're not following golf, this is one reason to follow it, this dramatic story. Tiny thing. She's playing in the John Deere Classic in Illinois. Going into today's round, she was only one stroke to make the cut. Now, just put that in context.
Well, half the field makes the cut. Michelle Wee has an excellent chance going into day two, an excellent chance to make the cut. You have to see. You have to decide for yourself whether the more remarkable thing is that Michelle Wee is a woman making the cut in a PGA tournament, or that Michelle Wee is a 15-year-old making the cut in the PGA tournament. Maybe they're equally amazing.
Well, and I do not follow golf as much as others. She's playing the men. Why isn't she playing Annika Sorenstam and the women?
She does
as well
play against the women. She played in the Women's Open a little earlier this summer.
Can she dethrone her, Sorenstam?
Well, you know what the results in the Women's Open showed is that there's a handful of U.S. teenagers who may be the next Annika Sorenstam. You look down the list of the top finishers; they were 17, 18, 15, 19. No lack of great young female golfers.
Well, let's go to the other end of the age spectrum, because last night I attended the match between the Boston Lobsters, get it, Lobsters,
yeah,
and the New York Sports Times.
And I don't get Sports Times, by the way.
I don't either. And I saw the match of the Martinas, Hingis and Navratilova. Imagine that, Martina Hingis, 24, getting to play the idol she was named after, Martina Navratilova at 48, or Martina Navrapopover, as my nieces called her. But my niece is screaming for Martina Navratilova. They're 7 and 9. You know, she gave such a boost to the attendance. Briefly, team tennis, is that going to take off?
Well, team tennis has been around for a long time. It's just returned to Boston. It was in Boston 30 years ago, but it's been in and out of various cities over the past 30 years. It's the ultimate niche sport. You find a place where a small and loyal fan base exists, and you run your team tennis franchise. And it does all sorts of wonderful things, and Billie Jean King comes to town and promotes it as energetically as she ever did, and it's a good show.
I'm telling you something. The Lobsters give away rackets to kids under 16.
Absolutely.
I'm lining up.
League policy. They do it everywhere they play.
How old am I? Can I get a racket? It was terrific fun. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, thanks for weighing in on this Friday.
Thank you, Robin.
As we head into the weekend. And thank you for listening. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a good weekend, and please join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.